I don't know who's with me on this, but there are few bad feelings as a Canadian, or I bet as anybody who lives in a cold weather climate, as when you have to break out the parka. When you know all your nice jackets, all your fun jackets, those are gone. Now it's just about functionality. Now it's just all about don't freeze to death out there in the harsh Canadian winter. God, we're there today. We're there today. I didn't do it, though. I did the sucker move of coming into work and being a little touch cold. Going like, oh, I'm still holding on to this. It'll turn around. No. Idiot. Just cold. I don't need gloves yet. I think it's... No, just cold. Just stupid and cold. That's all you are today. Tomorrow, we're reaching into the closet and we're grabbing the parka. I'm fired up today because everything went my way football-wise, which we'll discuss today with Brady Quinn. Niners dead. Oh, so sweet. So sweet. If you're a Niners fan, you don't want to listen to the second block of the show. Seahawks in first in the division. Bills looking phenomenal. So much. Bets just hitting left, right, and center. Some great stats that we have for stats you should know today. So a lot of football on the show. But first, I got some housekeeping with the Toronto Maple Leafs and some hockey in general. So number one is I did Kipper and Bourne on Friday. I was a guest on their show during their Leafs Hour, which is a great hour. These guys, I love the way that they chop it up. You know, I'm friendly with all of them. Do a show with Sammy. So always enjoy getting a chance to go on. And I had mentioned earlier last week that I didn't want to do a lot of Marner stuff. And I genuinely don't think I'm going to do much more for quite some time unless something changes that is out there for the next little while. Like, might come up in the odd conversation, but I feel like I really beat a lot of the Marner discussion into the ground last week because I think for good reason, but I've made my position clear. I don't think that the Leafs should be trying to negotiate in season. And my understanding of the situation was always that it wasn't really going to happen. But the more that I've asked people, the more my understanding is that Toronto is really trying to get something done now. That there are really competitive offers on the table. And that this is not coming down to simply like what a lot of people believe, which is between 12 and 13 million. And if the Leafs just hold firm, I asked Kiprios the question that I've been asking myself and of others, which is if this goes on, if this goes and drags throughout the regular season and the Leafs are not capitulating to all the demands of Mitch Marner and the camp in which he is represented, will things turn ugly? Will it turn into a situation where Marner feels aggrieved? Because I think it's fair to ask that, right? Hey, was it ever a question that they were going to go and meet Auston Matthews' demands? William Nylander had a terrific start to his regular season, much like Mitch Marner's start to his. I still, again, do believe that it was very different, but either way, there are a lot of similarities with it, and the Leafs were actively trying to get it done and, in fact, did so basically as soon as it turned into 2024. So would Marner feel some kind of way if he, for whatever reason, was the odd man out in this circumstance? If he was the guy that was the only one who didn't get treated the same way when he felt as though, hey, you know what? I'm just as good as these guys. I'm just as important as these guys. And when I asked Kipper about it, he did. He flipped it back on me. He's like, yeah, do you feel like you're getting the impression that the Leafs are not trying to work on something right now? And I went, no, because when I've asked people about it, I've been told that Marner and his, like, Marner wants a lot, but that the Leafs have offered a lot. And Kipper's response was really interesting, and I recommend people go back and listen to it because I don't want to misquote him entirely, and I don't want to, like, put words in his mouth that weren't there. But he did mention that there are considerations for Marner about the market in general and where he wants to be for the rest of his career, or at least a good chunk of the next phase of his career. Did mention that he's starting a family. And I think that it is fair for somebody who was genuinely had a spotlight on them as a little kid that he would not be thinking about what it would be like to be raised in the city of Toronto as Mitch Marner's kid, right? Like, those are real things. So again, the impression to me that is being made right now is that this is not necessarily an issue of the dollars and cents so much as it is an issue of what Mitch Marner wants and when he wants to do it, that this is not the Leafs holding out like a lot of people want, including myself. This is not the Leafs trying to establish some type of internal cap structure and get back on track and win negotiations. That this is actually very similar to we can and we will. In fact, I find it ironic, and I've mentioned this, I think, before. Probably should have just saved it for a tweet, but a lot of people who hated Kyle Dubas and could not stand we can and we will now seem to be in that exact same position. Now seem to be making essentially that same argument when it comes to Mitch Marner. But either way, it looks like what I said with Vladimir Guerrero Jr. this past week, or what Ben Nicholson-Smith said on the show, which is, seems like the decision has now no longer become whether the Blue Jays will extend Vladimir Guerrero Jr. to a big contract, but whether Vladimir Guerrero Jr. wants to receive a big contract from the Blue Jays. And I think that the situation is very similar with Mitch Marner. Anyways, Four Nations is also this week, and I'm going to do my roster today. At some point, if I don't, maybe I'll do it tomorrow. But either way, I got to get to Luke Fox, NHL and Sportsnet. I think he's been sitting on the line. What's up, Luke? How we doing, brother?
I'm doing good. How are you?
I'm doing okay. Sorry. How long did you sit there? Forever? I told him to get you early, but then I ranted a little longer than I expected to.
From the beginning.
Okay.
I got your football takes. I got everything.
Okay. Are you a Niners fan?
That's, no, one of my best friends is.
Oh, so good.
And he's crushed. Yeah.
Good. Send him my regards. let him know that I'm thinking of him today. Okay. So I don't know. You just heard all my thoughts on Mitch Marner. I'm curious if that's kind of the gist of what you've been hearing lately as well.
Well, I mean, I have not heard that they, like, I haven't heard any numbers, but certainly the sense is they want to keep him. Mm-hmm. And I did hear Kipper and Bourne, and I thought that was a really interesting segment. I like how Kipper framed it, that maybe this is more Mitch waiting and trying to decide. But is that really such a surprise? He has always had the leverage. It has always been his call. What happens next? If the Leafs are making a hard push and throwing big numbers, I would find that a little disappointing, just because I would hope that they would have learned from what happened last year, where they really signed William Nylander when he was at his absolute peak. And Mitch Marner is going through the same thing right now. He was phenomenal in November. Mm-hmm. One of the best players in the league. He was the engine that kept the team afloat during Austin Matthews being out 9 games. They play their first game apart under Craig Berube in Tampa, and he was equally as good. I like the fact that they're split. He's a fantastic hockey player. If he wants 13, if he wants 13.5, I'm sure if he goes to market, he'll get that from some team. I don't know if that team is going to be one that's as ready to win a Stanley Cup or is a contender. Mm-hmm. But if he wants to be the man in another market, that's another thing I think people should consider. I mean, his kids are going to have to be pretty old by the time they start paying attention to what other kids in the schoolyard are saying, considering they're not born yet. But I wonder, one thing that's crossed my mind is, does he want to be the guy? Because he's never going to be the guy here, right?
The Kevin Durant question.
He's going to be Geno Malkin to Austin Sid, mm-hmm. as long as he's here. So whether that means being the guy in terms of making the most money or being the guy who's talked about as the team MVP, mm-hmm. does he want to play second fiddle? I think that's a really interesting question.
You know what I'm kind of curious about too, with the Four Nations stuff and the Olympics kicking back up, is, you know, in the NBA, every time guys on Team USA, they go and play for Team USA, you're aware of the conversations that happen. Yes. Super teams get formed. Guys talk about their futures. Guys discuss, hey, where would you be and who would you play with and where would you go and what kind of a situation would you like? And it has materialized in things like the horrible Brooklyn Nets team, right? The better version of that is the Miami Heat, who ended up it being LeBron James and Dwayne Wade and Chris Bosh. And yeah, hockey's very different in terms of the money. And so a lot of guys are way more likely to stay in hockey than they are in the NBA, right? Just in terms of the amount of money that they can make, trying to maximize the return on the dollar. But yeah, with the rising cap and yeah, being a free agent of that ilk, I would be very curious after a summer where Marner got to see himself with McKinnon, got to see himself with McDavid, got to see himself with the top tier Canadian players, what those guys would be saying with him in private moments when they're just hanging out And they are asking about free agency, right? Whether or not there would be a player there that he really bonds with or gets along with and goes, you know, it wouldn't be the worst thing. You know, here's some of the perspectives of what it's like for guys in other markets. And especially hearing from other guys who do believe that Toronto is an impossible place to play in given the market pressure.
Yeah, I'm sure those conversations have. I know they even happen over All-Star weekend.
Yeah.
So when you got, you know, almost two weeks together at the Four Nations, and then, you know, they would probably kick up again in the summer when the Olympic teams start doing their trials. You know, they're hockey players, but they're humans. Like, you got all that time on the plane and the bus together. I'm sure those conversations happen. Mm-hmm. It's interesting that you mentioned Nathan MacKinnon, because Colorado is probably mm-hmm. the most close in terms of a parallel situation in the fact that the Avalanche aren't willing to meet Mikko Rantanen's number, and both Rantanen and Marner as the top UFAs, mm-hmm. you know, Shesterkin too, but he's a bit different animal since he's a goalie, but they play for good teams. The two teams are trying to establish an internal cap, but that internal cap was made with Matthews and MacKinnon based on, you know, the cap going up a modest amount, whereas all of a sudden, you know, we're in a summer where it's going to go through the roof. And it probably could go through the roof again the next year. Like, so the agents are saying, I don't care about your internal cap. This is what my player is worth, especially mm-hmm. if he signs for 8 years. This deal is, you might have to go above your best player or who you thought was your internal ceiling guy.
Yeah.
So really fascinating situation. So if Colorado can't get something done with the Avs, you wonder if Nathan MacKinnon's going up to the head office and saying, I really like playing with this Mitch guy. I'm fascinated to see whose line Mitch is on. You know, is he with Connor? Is he with MacKinnon?
Mm-hmm.
It's Sid. Like, it's gonna be fascinating. Like, the rosters, there's gonna be a couple surprises, but the line combinations are gonna be like great conversation starters.
Yeah, you know what? Maybe I'll do my Team Canada with you, because I have Marner with MacKinnon because of the stuff from the summer. And yeah. I do think that's interesting. And I want to play this out just because this is fun, right? Like, this is just fun. I think this is a fun sports fan conversation. If you were Mitch Marner, right? And Mikko Rantanen didn't get his deal done in Colorado. And I know there's all these tampering rules now, right? They're like, no tampering. And so you get absolutely killed on this. But yeah, what's to stop MacKinnon from giving a good sense that he feels like he and Marner have a pretty good relationship? Your point about, hey, he wants to be the man, that's well put. Like, I think that that's a good one. But I kind of think he could have his cake and eat it, too, because here's the thing. You want to be the man, for sure. I could see anybody wanting that, especially who is that good. But part of it, too, is that if you did go to Colorado, sure, you're not going to be as beloved as Nathan MacKinnon, right? But right. you're also not going to you're going to be more the number two, like, or the partner than you are here, right? Where it does seem, it's just Matthews' team. Everyone in Toronto has been conditioned to go, this is Matthews' team, this is Matthews' team. Then there's a huge faction of people who are Nylander fans. Marner is never going to be beloved here in this way, especially because he wants the money as well, which is fine, right? Like, in any other circumstance, it's fine. It's just that this guy happens to be from here. And so when there have been these guys that go over, even though Nylander's contract was high, right? It was above cap percentage of David Pastrnak. There was really no justification that you could make at the time to me that William Nylander should get a higher cap percentage than David Pastrnak. I'm sorry. You cannot do it to me. But people went, it's fine. It's William Nylander, whatever. He got it done. He's perfect for the market, blah, 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 blah. With Marner, if he plays here, there are always going to be questions about, you know, whether or not he can handle the pressure and him being the number two. And why did he take all the money if he's from Ontario and he loves it so much? That dynamic goes out the window if he goes to a place like Colorado. So he would have a chance to win. He would be welcomed as a conquering hero, right? Someone who chose Colorado, someone who was coming there to play with Nathan MacKinnon. He would get to play with one of the greatest stars in the games who he absolutely pairs with. And he would also get all the money without any of the feeling of like he was overpaid, because he comes in as a free agent, which means that they didn't have to give anything but the money up, which fans love, right? Which that's what the Tavares argument was. So I actually think that they're the most interesting place out of all the concocted Marner destinations is actually that vacuum that you mentioned, if the Rantanen thing doesn't work out, which by all indications kind of feels like there's some real steam that he will hit unrestricted free agency and that he won't return to that team.
Yeah. I mean, it's a really find the hypothetical.
Yeah, that's all we're doing, but that's fine.
But that is all we're doing. Yeah. Like, you know, Rantanen has said, I want to stay. Marner has said, I want to stay. I love this team.
So, as you know, athletes, when they say that, it's the most true. You know, if you can put it down in pen. It's just a GM saying they're not going to fire a coach, right?
No,
like all these things. The truth is the truth.
I am saying, though, in hockey, a lot of guys just end up re-signing
of course.
With the team. Like, that is probably still the most likely outcome.
But of course.
It is fun to dream. And it would make sense if deep down he is tired of it. I mean, Avalanche fans, they're not nearly as vocal on social media or anywhere. They're just a little more accepting. They're a little more just root for the home team.
Sing Blink-182. Like, sing your Blink-182 and be happy with the team.
They're happy.
Yeah.
They're happy.
I don't know. I just, again, of course, if this is not a what do I think is most likely segment. This is not a, hey, this isn't even me being like, hey, watch out. It's just a little fun chat. It's just a little fun chat with two friends thinking about something that's fun. Just like this.
Yeah.
Hey, I would like to let you know, I'm not part. I know that Team Canada extended being like an associate GM to basically every Canadian on the planet, because like Dubas was invited. So it was like, okay, if Kyle Dubas is a part of it, then whatever. The bar is fairly low for who gets to be a part of this management group. But I'm not the GM. I'm not a part of the front office, but I have put together my Team Canada for the Four Nations. And I'd like to go through it with you. And you tell me where there are sore spots and you stop me with what you think should be an alternative or something that's in and out. Are you good with that?
Okay.
Okay. So line one, point McDavid, Reinhardt. Line two, Hagel, MacKinnon, Marner. Line three.
Hagel that high, eh? Okay.
I got to tell you. But when I get through the rest of the guys, too, like you tell me where, you know, how he's going to get bumped down. But I will say this. Hagel, to me, has become one of my favorite players to watch in all of hockey. Like, I just think that he is the epitome of a guy that you put on Team Canada that can play up and down your lineup in a variety of different roles and bring a style of play that to me feels like the return of Canadian hockey. Because like we've only had junior tournaments the last, what? How long has it been since the Olympics? 2014? Decade? Ugh,
yes.
Dark to say. When I see a lot of these junior hockey tournaments, you know what I think is that we've lost some of what makes Canada hockey, Canada hockey. And I think that part of what is going to happen at this Four Nations and the following Olympics is the return of what actually makes us different culturally with this sport. And to me, Hagel actually fits some of that mold while also having the skill. And I think that he could play there. Again, you bring talent so that you can move things around, but this would just be the day one things. Line three, Marchand, Crosby, Konechny. Line four, this is my favorite line. I call them the care line. Stone, Shifley, Wilson. So you got some size, you got some meanness, some real competitiveness, just a hell of a checking line. Then my extra forward, Verhaeghe. Thoughts on the forward group, who you cannot have there.
You're missing Anthony Cirelli.
So I thought so too, but it was between him and Shifley, and I didn't know what to do with that.
I love the season Shifley's having. Mm-hmm. Apparently he's hurting right now. He's a little banged up.
Mm-hmm.
I think he deserves to be there.
Mm-hmm.
Verhaeghe, he's such a big game player, but I just don't know. So we talked to John Cooper on the weekend about Team Canada,
mm-hmm.
and the way he talked about Cirelli and Hagel
mm-hmm.
seemed to me that they're probably on the team.
Yeah,
Cirelli's
I like them.
Such a good two-way guy. He'll kill penalties. You could sick him on Matthews or Eichel, or mm-hmm. you know, he'll take on the hard matchups. He's won cups. I don't know. And the fact that the coach knows him and you know, Doug Armstrong and Don Sweeney have said that John Cooper, his voice really matters in terms of roster selection. It's not just, here, we pick the team, you coach the guys we want you to coach. Cooper's very involved. And the way he was talking about Cirelli, I think he's going to be on this team.
Yeah, I can't even push back on it, too, because one of my thoughts watching the Leafs game Saturday night was, well, don't you just have your PK1 right there with Hagel and Cirelli?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, is it, don't you just have them? Like, don't you go with some of the duos and just say, like, hey, here's two of the guys?
It looks like they're going with a couple duos on the back end, too.
Yeah.
Just because that's the other thing. Cooper stressed this is a short tournament. Like, mm-hmm. if Canada goes to the gold medal game, there's four games
mm-hmm.
total. So it's such a quick turnaround that and there's not going to be like a whole bunch of practice time, that I think they're going to try and bank on some built-in chemistry.
Okay.
With, yeah.
Yeah, it's a fair one. It's a fair one. Like I said, this is just this is the original mock out, and I wanted to talk it out with you, and I think that you're presenting a really good case. And the reason why I had Verhaeghe as the extra guy over him is just because I did feel like, hey, don't you want to have somebody else who you feel like is a big goal scorer in the mix? Yeah. Don't you want to feel like there's someone else around if one of these line combinations doesn't work out that you can just kind of put him in there? Or you just even do have the Panthers line where it's like you put him on the wing next to, you know, like he's there, Reinhardt's there, you put like a McDavid in the middle and you just see how that the chips fall.
Yeah, he's a big game player. Mm-hmm. I think they want a little bit more defensive element to their forwards because they're worried about the goalies. So I love having Mark Stone on my fourth line. He's such a good two-way player. Yeah. That's why maybe we would pick Cirelli over Verhaeghe.
Yeah, Cirelli with Stone would be great. I just loved the idea of having Scheifele and Wilson getting into the faces of other players on that line and knowing Stone has some of that edge to his game too. Seeing those three on a line, oh, it would warm my heart. It really would. Like, it would just make me feel good inside, seeing them get in the corners, seeing them in scrums in front of the net, and just feeling like you've got the baddest group, right? Like, somebody that's getting in the face of the Kachucks, and you say, yeah, I feel good about where Canada stands. That to me is great. Like, Team Canada, 2014 had such a good intimidation factor. It was on the blue line, but it really was there, you know? Like, you had Shea Weber, you had Drew Doughty, you had just, like, a real team with real size. And I don't think that the blue line is the same this time around, which I'll get into now. Okay, so no. Taves, Makar, like, we're doing that, right?
Yeah, I think so. Okay. And Theodore Petrangelo, I think, too.
Yep, so that's my next one. Then it gets probably a little bit more controversial for me because I'm going Morrissey Tanev and then Uyghur as the extra guy.
Oh.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah. I know if people will say homer pick, but every single inclination in my bones tells me that you would never feel bad about having a Morrissey Tanev pairing on the ice. And that Chris Tanev, again, you're talking about that Cirelli argument, then I would make the same one for Chris Tanev.
I'm not going to go against you. I love this guy's game. And you also have to realize, like, you know, like some of the names like Bouchard being thrown out there.
Absolutely not. Like,
oh, you only got one. Only one guy can run PP1.
Yep.
And it's going to be Makar.
Yep.
Right. So you need someone to be on the penalty kill. And the, like, Tanev's such a heart and soul guy. Like, blocks every shot. Every teammate who's ever played with him raves about this guy. So I think you want guys like that. I think it would be a fantastic choice. I'm not convinced it's going to happen, but I'm not going to argue with your choice. I think he'd be a fantastic addition on third pair.
Last is the goalies, and who cares? Because it's the same ones that basically everybody. I don't really care who has. Like, if someone's like, "Oh, I have Cam Talbot as my third guy," I'm like, "Whatever." You know, like, I just it's Binnington, and if he can't play well, you're screwed. Like, it's pretty much it. It's Binnington, it's Hill, and it's Thompson.
Yeah, I like Thompson on merit. The good conversation to have, and because again, we're talking about four games maximum. Mm-hmm. And like, if you're down to your third goalie, you're probably not making that fourth game.
No.
Is Marc-Andre Fleury just for vibes?
Yeah.
And keep Sid happy.
keep Sid happy.
You know, be the guy that hangs out and you take a million extra shots in practice. Like, you're probably not even playing, right? Or even dressing. So if it's him, I'm not going to cause a stink. But I love the Logan Thompson story. Undrafted guy.
Yeah,
you know, goes out and he says, "I'm not going to be the man." So I had a good talk with him a couple weeks ago, and he goes into Kelly McCrimmon's office and basically says, "Oh, Aiden Hill's your guy. Well, I'm a number one. So if I'm not the number one here, trade me."
He God, I love
like,
that.
Like, I love that attitude. Yeah.
No, that's awesome. Yeah. That's exactly what you want to hear from a guy. I saw, I think somebody tweeted out that it should just be Kelly McCrimmon that makes the decision on the goaltenders, right? It's like, hey, he's had them all, right? Like, all these guys, they've been with him at some point, all the bubble dudes. But I thought, I don't know, because maybe he made the wrong choice with his own team. So, maybe it wouldn't be that guy because of what's happened so far this year. Yeah, I think that it's pretty clear that whatever comes out of this, I think there's going to be conversations about hockey in Canada in general, just with, like, the declining rate, especially of young men playing the sport. How expensive the sport has become, how homogenous, how professionalized. Like, there's a lot of problems that I just don't know how they fix, especially at the youth level. But But the goaltending stuff, I think, is going to come into pretty sharp focus if it ends up being the thing that does cost Canada, and we're heading into an Olympic cycle. Anyways, that's my Team Canada.
Goalie summit.
Yeah, goalie summit, fine. Just have it. Let's do it. Let's figure it out. Because, yeah, if we're trying to beg for Joey Decord to get a passport, it's not great. You know? This can't be the way. This just cannot be the way. Okay, so, yes, I'll stick with goaltending to start with you first. So, sticking with goaltending. Wolves won 5 straight. He looks like the not having a training camp mattered, right? The way that he looked at the beginning of the season versus what he looks like now. They've got all these games coming up, so this really isn't that big of a story, in my opinion, because these guys, they're going to make them share the net. I think they always wanted Wool to be the number one, which is kind of fine. But, yeah, do you see anything, or is there any sense from you that they would lean on him a little bit more and that there would be starting to be a bit of a separation between who is the one and who is the two, even with the way that Stolarz has played, which has been phenomenal and I would argue could be the story of the season up until this point?
Yeah, it's tough, right? Because like you mentioned, that the way their schedule is, they really are going to lean on both guys. And they've gone out of their way to try and tamp down any conversation or potential controversy of this guy's our number one and this guy's the backup. They've just kind of stuck with the party lineup. We got two guys. They're both going to play more than they've ever played. We need them both. And it's not a lie, but internally, for sure, you want the younger guy. You want the guy that you drafted and developed and have poured all these resources in and gave him a raise before he really earned it. I mean, phenomenal goalie, but just didn't have the resume, didn't have the games played, didn't have the track record of staying healthy when you gave him $15 million or whatever. Mm-hmm. You internally, it makes sense. You want that guy to be the guy, but he's still got to do it. Mm-hmm. And one of the biggest things I've noticed is, you know, of course he missed the start of the game because of the groin tightness or whatever. But it was more just how he was. He was feeling the pressure because, you know, when you talk to him, his answers were a little bit more clipped. He wasn't as chatty. And now it's like you're talking to a different person. He's joking around. He's having casual conversations. He's way more relaxed. And that's just, he's confident. And he's confident because he's won a bunch. He loves the defense he's playing in front of. That's the other thing. Both goalies look good in part. Like, they're both positionally sound, good big goalies, but in part why they're playing so well is Berube's structure and the fact they went out and got two more real defensemen, like we were talking about Tanev. Wool just raves about how much this team is willing to block shots. And if you look at the Leaf shot blocks, they're climbing up the charts. They blocked way more that you know, per 60 or whatever than they did last year. So the goalies are loving playing behind Berube's system and this blue line. And just Wool, I think, mentally is in a much better spot. He's feeling it right now. Mm-hmm. And the only thing I would caution is because, and it's partly just the schedule, it was such a long break between games there, is I wonder if Anthony Stolarz needs to keep going in a rhythm. He looked a little not quite dialed in to start that Florida game. And maybe it's being back in that building, I don't know. But it took him a while to find his groove in that Panthers game. And I don't know if you can wait and sit either guy too long. Mm-hmm. Like, I think it just makes sense to try and balance it out right now.
Yeah, I'm with you. Okay, so you mentioned that, like the structure with Berube and how different this team is defensively. And everybody is acknowledging that right now, right? Like, the amount of goals that they were scoring and have been scoring at 5-on-5, and yet the record they've accumulated, it's impossible to deny, right? Those differences, their ability to defend and their ability to get this, just their ability in net in general. I am curious, though, as somebody who's there on the day-to-day, if there is a different feeling or mood around the team than there has been in years prior.
I mean, I don't know if the mood is all that different. I think they definitely have a different, the changes in the system, the changes in the coach, mm-hmm. I think have been positive. And I think it took them a while to figure it out. I think it was a bit of a shakeup. Okay, this is how we're going to play. You know, we're dumping and chasing. We're a forecheck team now. If we don't play strong defensively, it's going to get called out. Like, this is this is quite an adjustment. I mean, they used to be number one or two pretty much every year in five-on-five scoring, and now all of a sudden they're being asked to play in more low-event games. And for some guys, I think it's perfect. Like, this is perfect for Matthew Nyes. He's a straight-line guy. Go to the net. You know, now he's studying tape of Zach Hyman and how to get tips and greasy rebound goals. And that's, like, Berube's system is made for this guy. Some other guys, I think it's a bit of like, okay, how do I fit in here? You know, William Nylander's natural instinct is not to dump it in and go chase it. You know, he still likes to cut through the neutral zone. And, you know, at times it's costly. At times you need it. So there's been a bit of an adjustment. I do think the mood of the coach has had a positive effect. I think Sheldon Keefe was understandably under pressure. I think he was wound pretty tight. Mm-hmm. And Berube is strict and direct, but he also, you know, has a laugh. He's a little bit more calm. Like, he doesn't ride the roller coaster as much as the former coach. And I think that has had a positive effect in terms of you're talking about mood around the team.
Yeah, I just don't see how it couldn't. And the other thing, too, is when you're around people, and again, I'm really trying to make this clear that I don't want this to be like a shot at Sheldon Keefe, because I think that the guy worked his ass off and he had to learn part of it on the job, and that some of this was circumstantial. Like, everything that people who have been around Keefe have told me, like, and it's been a few of them, is like, this guy is the most attention to detail guy that there is, that, like, he does not take things lightly. But when you're around people who are stressed out all the time, that can bleed into others, right? Like, having the pressure of wondering if it's going to be your job on the line day in, day out, having someone who is, like, obsessed with the tiny details, I think that can be exhausting for others. I know I'm that kind of guy. Like, I'm that kind of person who cares about every little detail, every little thing. And every once in a while, I got to check myself being like, okay, like, oof, you know, let that one go, you know, like, because it's not going to do well for the group if you're just kind of going over all those tiny little things all of the time. And so I would just imagine that, yeah, having someone who is a little bit more reserved when it comes to the way that they're speaking, a little bit calmer in terms of demeanor, that could not have a negative effect on a group that, to me, kind of already has enough pressure on them, already probably feels the weight of the world constantly, that those kinds of things are actually going to be meaningful for this group.
Well, I think so. Sheldon comes in and it's his first organization as a coach.
Learning on the fly.
Learning on the fly under tons of pressure. You got all this high-end talent, they're in their win a cup now window, tons of pressure. So I think he put a ton of pressure on himself to really drill down on studying every opponent. Mm-hmm. You know, in the pregame talks, I'll give you an example. You know, some teams coming in and Sheldon would say, well, they're third on rush chances, so really got to protect the rush, and they do this well. And you know, Berube's tone is more just the same every day. It's more about what the Leafs need to do. We need to go to the net. We need to play direct. We need to screen the goal. And it's always the same stuff. It kind of didn't matter. It doesn't matter who the opponent is. They want to play the Leafs way. Whereas I think Sheldon was such a student of the game and working so hard at his job that he was almost more focused of how do we beat this opponent on this night? And I got to think about which lines I'm going to start. Whereas Berube's kind of, no, we're who we are. We want to be the same way, whether we're home or away, and we're going to impose our identity onto you. Mm-hmm. And I think that's just the confidence that comes from, you know, winning a cup, being around the league a long time, mm-hmm. multiple organizations, seeing how different things work. And also to think that, you know, that I think they're both good coaches. I just think their minds work differently.
Yeah.
And I think it was, and you know, Keefe's doing a great job with the Devils. But I think it was overdue that they just had a different voice in there.
Yeah, there's just no. I just think that there's just absolutely no doubt about it. Bubble guys. So I was talking about this on Leafs Talk Saturday, that if you watch that game, there were maybe seven forwards that were going to be on the playoff roster. Like, there's just going to be a ton of turnover, whether it's just the internal guys that come back or players that they add at the deadline. Dudes moving in and out of that group. It's like what makes it kind of really encouraging watching them, and also harder to criticize when they do lose to teams like the Panthers. Again, you don't want to have it be a complete lack of accountability. But yeah, it's tough to say, I can't believe you didn't beat the Panthers in a basically a must win for them on in their barn when you were playing a second line that included Nick Robertson and Pontus Holmberg, right? Like, mm-hmm. it's kind of fair just to at least mention in those circumstances. But again, they've done well. But some of these guys coming back, I'm not as concerned about some of the guys because it's the same thing as the Steve's thing where you go, okay, yeah, just back down to the minors, easy peasy. But what is your sense of the timeline on Domi? Because it feels like, yeah, like we've got some guys where we know it's going to be a while, so some of these guys are going to get extended looks. But what is your understanding of the timeline with Domi?
Yeah, I hopefully we get more information in about an hour when they morning skate. So yeah. he didn't travel with the team. He hasn't skated. It went from he's pushing through it and we're just giving him some practices off mm-hmm. to all of a sudden his last practice he finished and immediately left. Like the other guys were hanging around, you know, working on their one-timers or face-offs or whatever. As soon as the whistle blew, he took off. We haven't seen him since and find out he's on IR. So he was battling some for a while. It's obviously gotten pretty bad. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's not been a big story just in the fact that they keep winning and that cures all and it's given all these guys extra time to heal up. But yeah, I can't give you a timeline. I think it's concerning the fact that, you know, he hasn't been skating and not even traveling with the team. Like usually if you're getting close, you travel so that you can practice and the Leafs had a couple practices when they're in Florida and be around the guys and all that good stuff. But he stayed back and is probably getting some sort of treatment, you know, lower body. It's everything's under lock and key these days.
Well, yeah, it's interesting for two reasons to me. One is how much it's like mirroring what happened with Austin Matthews. And two is what you kind of mentioned there where, hey, okay, he's not traveling, he's not doing these things. Okay, sure, the Leafs schedule was so light. There was almost this implication that, hey, with the limited amount of games that they were playing over such a large stretch, now was a sensical time to give guys an extra few games off, right? But now that they're back under the gun here, and it's like, yeah, we're playing a million games, and every night the Leafs play now. It's just every night there's a game. Every night you and I are working. Hey, you'd assume that now is the time that, guys would be getting back, and the fact that he isn't is the interesting one. And again, when you're talking about the forward group and we're having these conversations of, like, who's in, who's out, well, it's pretty easy if there's no guys who are coming back in.
Yeah, exactly. But I think, so Alex Nylander is the interesting one for me just because he requires waivers and he's on such a cheap deal. Like there's injuries around the league. Like does someone scoop him and break William's heart? Maybe. Mm. But it's pretty obvious to me from how Berube uses him that, you know, he's the next guy out. And maybe he would have been, if it was up to the coach, maybe he would have been sent down before Alex Steeves even. I don't see it. And he's not really trusted. And he was given a shot even on the top power play unit for like half a game and you know, lost that spot right away. So he seems to be on the outs. And Minton and Gravenkin don't require waivers. And it's probably best for those guys individually to play more time with the Marlies anyway. Mm-hmm. I think this has been great. You get a free look at what they look like at the NHL level. I don't think there's anything, you know, negative about this, but I'm with you. Like Pontus Holmberg's still in the top six, like Steven Lorenz. I love the guy, but now he's on the third line when really he's just an awesome fourth liner. Mm-hmm. So eventually they need the healthy bodies. And for my money, I still think there's at least one trade at forward coming.
Okay, so that's the kind of where I was going to close this one because, to summarize my Nylander 2 thoughts, then Alex, like, I don't care what happens. If Nylander's disappointed, it's like, hey, man, you know how you have that $11.8 million coming your way? Or it's like, hey, that's that. You'll be fine. This is a luxury, not a necessity. And I would say to any team that actually claims Alex Nylander, like, okay, you know, like, sure, I guess. You going to play him? Because, I don't know. I think there's a reason why he didn't get an NHL contract in the first place, even though there are reports that he maybe turns him down to go to Toronto. It's totally fine. The same thing with Mint and Grubenkin. Eventually, you kind of want them back there. And if you're not getting that help right away from some of the other forwards, right? Like some of these dudes are going to be out for a while. You're seeing transactions around the NHL early this season. Do you get any sense that Toronto would want to expedite a timeline to bring a body in here, even though they don't have a lot of bullets to shoot when it comes to trades and the assets to acquire players?
No, not unless there's a really good deal.
Yeah.
But they're not going to, no, I don't get the sense that they, because they've done fine. Like,
yeah.
Think about all the, like, because their goalies have been good, because the defense has been healthy, knock wood. Like, Jake McCabe had that scare, but after the game, Berube said he should be good to go tonight. So, because that's been fine, and because they've been getting by, and now Austin's back, it's like they kind of weathered the storm already. And so, yeah, are they, of course, he's kicking tires and everything, but I don't feel like the Leafs feel the need to make a move just yet. I think they want to, you know, there's only so many picks they have. There's only so many prospects that teams are interested in. They have to be smart with these bullets. And I think they have, for my money, I think they should swing big and see what second line, maybe third line center is out there in a couple months and try and go for the biggest one available. Like, this is a good team. I question their secondary scoring, but the goalies stay healthy. The D stays healthy. They have the legit game breakers up front. They need some support. And I think this could be the year more than others where they should actually go for the high end shopping instead of, you know, the Lyubushkins of the world.
Yep. Totally agree. Luke, thanks as always for the time, buddy. I always appreciate you.
Okay. Have a good one, JD. Thanks for having me on.
Cheers. Luke Fox, NHL and Sports Center. All right. Quick break. Come back. Hit Stats You Should Know.
Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
It's time for Stats You Should Know. It's Monday. So my favorite numbers from the weekend. The first one is just a personal petty gripe. It's a stat that I want all of you to know. When I was in university, one of my roommates is one of the reasons that I got way more into football. I was always a football fan, but it was a clear number four for me. And yeah, I didn't have the same traditions on Sundays as I would soon have after I met my roommate, Sean, who is a diehard Jets fan. And his passion for the Jets helped create part of my passion for football. The trash talk, and the Jets were like, that was the last time that they were halfway decent. This is the Rex Ryan era, you know? And they're doing fine, and my Seahawks lost the Super Bowl. So there was a lot of vitriol, a lot of trash talk, and the Jets were the team on the rise. And so we would have NFL Sundays, and of course we had many TVs, many horrible TVs, many terrible, ugly bubble TVs that were inherited from parents' basements and other miscellaneous spots in the houses that were like, hey, don't worry, have this. So we had a setup with multiple, but we always had to watch the stupid Jets games. And the Seahawks beat the Jets this weekend. And I like the Seahawks. In fact, they are still my favorite football team, despite the pain that they have caused me since winning a Super Bowl now, a decade ago. But the Jets and the Hawks, in my 20-year friendship with this person, the Jets have never won. The Jets have never beat the Seattle Seahawks. In the last 20 years, has not happened. The last time it was 2004. So that's six straight. That's a stat you should know. Six straight wins for the Seattle Seahawks over the hapless Jets, in which my friend and so many of you continue to cheer for, even though out of basically any franchise that exists, they have given you the least reason to cheer for them. So congrats to Jets fans. You got embarrassed again. Rodgers blew another lead. He went to the podium and still made more excuses, as Aaron Rodgers does. And I will say, too, as a Seahawks fan who's feeling good, listen, it's a week-to-week league, all right? It's a week-to-week league. It was also very nice. It was very a good feeling. This is not just a shot at the Jets. This is not just a shot at Shoddy. This is also a shot at Packers fans, because I know somewhere in your hearts you still care about Aaron Rodgers, that you still remember the good times. And when you see the Seattle Seahawks beating Aaron Rodgers, are there memories? Do things come into your little Packer brains? Because I think they do. I think you remember. I think you remember just exactly what the Seahawks did during all of Aaron Rodgers' career as he was trying to lead you to Super Bowls. And the team that just kept denying that window over and over again. Replacement refs or not in some cases. Golden Tate in some cases. Just remember. Remember, Packers fans, who your daddy was and who helped end Aaron Rodgers' career throughout it and then did it there again on Sunday. So for the Jets fans and the Packers fans, just remember, just think about it. Seahawks all day. Another stat. I'll save my love for the Niners fans for after Brady Quinn because, oh, you're getting it too. You are absolutely getting it today. The only other stat for that game is the Jets became the first team since 1998 to lose to two quarterbacks they drafted in the same season, Sam Darnold and Geno Smith. Congrats to the New York Jets. You are a disaster. Next stats, Bengals, ouchie. Teams are 79-7 this year when scoring 30 or more. Much has been made about the dip in scoring. Cincinnati owns 4 of those 7 losses. Oh, 4 of them. They gave up 41 points on Sunday to a team that had not scored 40 points since November of 2018. That's the Steelers. That's their offense. Week after week, Cincinnati has shown up and said, this is the do or die week. Well, they're dead. They're dead because their defense is horrific. And poor Joe Burrow has to go into this offseason and potentially lose T. Higgins after having that many games with 30 or more and feel like maybe their window has changed and that they might not get another crack at this for a little while. Again, I think that as long as Joe Burrow's there, they're going to be fine, but they've got really bad ownership, much like the New York Jets. And so the idea that they're just going to automatically be able to turn this around or that this is an offseason where they're going to make good on this football team, I don't think that that should just be taken for granted. Stat number 3, Josh Allen now has the most touchdowns in franchise history with 245, which is pretty incredible because they had Jim Kelly, right? He had an 11-year career there. This is Josh Allen in his 7th season. Yeah, it sure helps when he will run the ball in. It sure helps that now he will catch the footballs. He will get receptions, and he will throw for touchdowns, and he will rush for touchdowns. In fact, his receiving touchdown, this is a good one. He now has more touchdown receptions than Justin Jefferson does in the last 6 weeks. Yeah. Good comeback win for the Vikings, but something that should be sitting out there is JJ ain't getting his, and I don't know how long he's going to love that for. He is the first player in NFL history to have a passing touchdown, receiving touchdown, and a TD. Sorry, his first quarterback to do all of those things, but also the first player in NFL history to do it on two plays. And I don't think that we'll ever see that again. That is a stat that will never change. So to have a passing touchdown, receiving touchdown, and a rushing TD on two plays, that's next year impossible. That's just never going to be touched again. What you saw yesterday night, you will probably never, ever, ever see again. Unless maybe you were like 7 or 8 years old and you watched that game with your parents and you've got your whole life ahead of you to maybe see that happen again. Anyways, he's the 12th player in NFL history to have run, pass, and catch a TD in the same game. But again, first quarterback to do it. Anyways, those are the stats you should know from this past weekend. I really enjoyed them and more. More for the Niners fans later in the show, but Brady Quinn next. I got so many things from this week. This felt like a real NFL Sunday. This felt like an impactful NFL Sunday where like we really learned things, okay? So I got a lot. I got a lot, and especially dancing on the Niners grave. Oh, it feels so good. Oh, I'm so happy. But first, Brady Quinn, our Monday Morning Insider, of course, of Fox Sports and former NFL QB. But I got to start with this because you were there. You took it all in, that Ohio State loss. Oh, my God. The hype, the pomp, the circumstance around the weekend, Ryan Day and all the, he's so sad about losing to Michigan. And that's all about Michigan. And they, what were they, 20-point favorites in that game? 20 more? I think it was maybe even more than 20 points. And they lose. and they plant the flag, and there's all the fighting, and they... I want to know from you, college football guy, one of the preeminent voices, one of the most famous college football players ever, how deeply embarrassing that loss is for that program, and how long, if ever, they can recover from it.
It is crushing their soul.
Yeah.
I mean, I grew up in Columbus, Ohio. I grew up in an era where John Cooper, who had very similar to Ryan Day, very, very talented teams, the guys like Terry Glenn and David Boston and all these talented wide receivers that you figured, man, like, just get your ball to your playmakers, or they should be able to out-talent the team they're going up against in this Michigan team. But very similar to, you know, kind of Lloyd Carr back then and the way they've been able to kind of transform, and Bo Schembechler and some of the other greats of Michigan. It's the physicality, it's the grit, it's the toughness. And Michigan is just in the head of every Ohio State fan, every Ohio State coach and player, where they force them and they dictate them to play their game. And so it was crushing for their soul. I think to sit there and think they have to wait another 363 days before they can try to challenge Michigan again, who's going to be way better next season, by the way. Mm-hmm. They're getting a five-star top quarterback in the recruiting class who's going to come in and play right away. They'll be able to, you know, hit the transfer portal hard and replenish a roster that was down this year. And so that's the scary thing for Ohio State, is you're going to be dealing with a Michigan team that's much better in their house next year. And granted, it's only four games in a row, but people tend to forget the last time they beat them was 2019. So I've been in few places in my life where I've seen a stadium of 100,000-plus turn on their own team. Mm-hmm. And based on the play of how they played the second half, in particular on offense, that was kind of what you felt. The wind got knocked out of that fan base, the stadium. It almost became a feeling of, like, here we go again. And unfortunately for Buckeyes fans, it was the largest upset in the history of this storied rivalry.
So here's the thing. I can't stand Michigan. I don't like their fans. There's a pretty strong presence here in Toronto, and yeah, it's just not. Canada's different too, because, like, again, we're all fans. Like, a lot of fans that have college football didn't go to the schools. It's a different thing. It's a very, very, very separated, actually being in it, quotient. But, you know, I usually root for Schadenfreude, and I usually root for, hey, let me see a loss like this. Let me see a moment like this. That is about as sick as I've ever felt for a fan base that I do not care about with Ohio State, as I've ever felt empathy for a fan base. Like, watching some of their fans' reaction videos, looking at the stadium as they were in it, looking to the way that the people were speaking on it. Like, that seems to me like it's one of the more crushing, given the circumstances, given the spread losses that I've ever seen in college or professional sports.
You know what it probably was, too, is the glimpse into what Ohio State needed to do in order to win. Mm-hmm. And you saw it the final drive for Ohio State in the first half. I mean, Will Howard went straight down the field, and it was almost surgical. And they spread him out, went more up-tempo. They had to because of the two-minute situation. And then you saw, you know, some of the different throws to Buka or G. Scott or Jeremiah Smith. And Jeremiah Smith draws a defensive pass interference the second of the half. And then you see the touchdown pass to Smith, and you're going – oh, there it is. Like, they're just going to do this the entire second half. And Ohio State, for whatever reason, never came around to opening things up, airing it out. And I think that was in large part because they lost confidence in their quarterback. I mean, Will Howard made some crucial mistakes in his interceptions. And to be quite honest, he looked scared. You know, those last two drives, we were down on the field to watch it. And he looked like a guy who has never been on this big of a stage, didn't really have many great moments at Kansas State, bringing his team back in two-minute drives. And it showed in that moment. And I think the sad thing for Ohio State fans is it feels like a waste of talent. It feels like they went all in this year with guys coming back. And, yes, they can still win a national championship. But for people in Toronto and people who don't understand this, it would feel like there's an asterisk next to this because they didn't beat Michigan. Like, that's how big this rivalry is between Ohio State and Michigan.
Yeah. I think that we can absolutely understand that based on what we got through social media on Saturday. The amount that poured through was impossible to avoid. So then there's the flag planting thing, right? Like, everybody gets into a flag planting skirmish. And I hate that this happened for one reason and one reason only, is that I feel like now they're going to try to legislate this out of college football.
Right. I mean, my initial thought is you hate to see that. However, if you're Ohio State, you had 60 minutes to prove it on the field.
Oh,
and
yeah.
By the way, the way they physically beat you up on you know, up front on both sides, like, you're probably not winning that fight anyway. Like you already got your ass kicked. You got kicked out of the bar. I wouldn't go back for seconds because I don't think you're winning the post fight either. And again, you know, you had the opportunity to try to defend your home turf, and you didn't. Mm-hmm. That's how it works, man. And I know we saw this in Arizona State. They were actually trying to, you know, rip up and planning that was a trident or whatever it is, the Sun Devils, which then they realized this is actually kind of dangerous. This thing can actually stab someone.
Yeah, exactly.
So there were multiple occasions in rivalry weekend where we saw this in college football, but I'm with you. I hope they don't legislate it, because one of the things that I've noticed is, like, this is what rivalries are about.
Yes.
There should be fighting. There should be hatred. There should be that feeling of disappointment for a lot of those players and a lot of the fan bases. Like, that's why we love sports. Why try to take something out that, for as storied as this, you know, the history of these programs have been, this hasn't happened a bunch. So let's not all of a sudden make this act like this is this rampant thing that's happening around college football or in sports, and we need to, you know, throw it to the wayside or create a fine system or suspension system because of it. I would hate to see it. It's a couple isolated incidents on a rivalry week, and let's move on.
Yeah, I love it, but there was two things. One is that, what do we know about when there's big money athletics? They're very risk averse. And so for me, I'm just thinking they saw this and went, yep, we can't be having any more of this. And the big reason was that one of those cops pepper sprayed the Michigan players during that scrum. And I went, oh my God, that felt like a real tipping point moment where I'm like, okay, pepper spray got involved. That look of those players, like, in agony on the sideline with pepper spray in their eyes, that felt like something that's not just going to go and die down quietly and that they're going to move on. But I'm with you because, like, and I felt similar things with, like, when I get into the Bills and I'm watching them play in the snow game, there is just so much uniformity in all of sports right now across, you know, pros and college and the way that this, like, offenses that teams run. It's just so nice to see something that feels different. It's so nice to see something where it feels like there's real stakes, and removing even one little element of it would suck. Removing one even little piece that's as dumb as a flag planting would be terrible for sports fans in general. Like, that's just where I'm at with it. Anyways, I am ready to move on, even though, God, I'm sorry for, I guess, but if you are an Ohio State fan, like, you're not listening to any show for, I don't even know how long, right? Like, you just bury your head in the sand and you wait till the national championship game.
This is the hard thing for Ohio State fans, because there's a lot of people who probably want their coach fired. And there's a number of programs that want their coach fired, and obviously at the college football level here, these guys are paid so much now, mm-hmm. and their buyouts are so big, it's hard to do that. But the college football calendar is actually what prevents a lot of it. So this December 4th through December 6th is the early signing period, which it used to be the week after the Super Bowl mm-hmm. that we would get a lot of the high school recruits would sign their national letter of intent. That's not the case anymore. All these kids are getting to school earlier. They want to play earlier so they can get to the NFL earlier. So the truth is if you're going to fire your coach, like, right now, you better have that next guy ready right now to go recruit and go build that roster. Otherwise, you're not getting all those five-star, four-star high school recruits. The transfer portal window opens up December 9th to the 29th. So then your entire team is basically going to leave. And mind you, this is still a team that's going to be playing for the national championship. Oof. So it's a really hard time now if you are an athletic director or a university president to try to move on from your head coach, to try to retain any sort of roster that gives you any success the following season.
Well, and like, I saw a lot of people going, well, it's Vrabel time. I'm like, why would Vrabel want to go coach college football? He's going to get an NFL job eventually. And, like, he doesn't have to put up with all the things that you're talking about.
You know, my rebuttal to that would be the college football landscape is moving so much closer to the NFL. I mean, these scouting departments now that they're building out on the college side is very similar to the NFL. They're taking that model. They're bringing in general managers, as you see. Mm-hmm. Andrew Luck now takes over as Stanford's general manager. They're bringing in capologists because they're going to have to work with that. So it's actually become a position now where, depending on the university, they're building it out like an NFL team. So they're basically making the head coaching position now responsible for, you know, somewhat of the roster construction, no different than you would be on an NFL team going through the draft, going through free agency, but you have a lot more support than it used to be. And so it's actually becoming a lot closer to NFL than people think. And that's why guys like Arthur Smith have been, you know, thrown out there as far as a replacement at the University of North Carolina. And then Mike Vrabel's name even, but I'm with you. I mean, I would think the Las Vegas Raiders, especially with the chance they have of drafting a franchise quarterback, who knows, but that would make sense given the Tom Brady connection to Mike Vrabel.
Antonio Pierce really killed all interim head coaches ever getting the extensions. That's just done now. So you're going to look at that situation and be like, yeah, maybe we'll just go and hire someone different. All right. Last night, last night, who'd you learn more about, the Bills or the Niners?
That's a good question. I think we learned more, at least in this moment, about the 49ers, because I've never really questioned the Bills' ability to win games in the regular season. And I've always felt like Josh Allen's put himself in a position to be an MVP candidate. He's one of the best quarterbacks in the NFL. And I think, you know, every time we've talked this season so far, I think one of the things we've talked about in their offense is they're so much more balanced. You know, they're not relying all on Josh Allen to do things. James Cook, obviously, is phenomenal. But so I think it was the 49ers. It's like,
lose Brady? Yeah, I think we lost him. Rather, maybe he muted his phone. Or maybe he didn't. I don't think he dropped off because he's still on the line. Here's what I'll say about the Niners. I'll do this now as we try to get Brady back on. I think we definitely learn more about the 49ers because the window is closed. It's over, baby. It's done. The Kyle Shanahan era, c'est finito. You guys had a window where for half a decade, at least, maybe even a little bit more, you were the best team in the NFC. You were the juggernaut of the NFC. You were the bad boy of the NFC. You were the everything. You were the boogeyman. You kept knocking out the Packers. You kept getting the Super Bowls. You were there. You were scary. You were spooky. It's done. It's over. The team is old. McCaffrey left that game with I don't remember what it is. It's a calf injury, I think, that, you know, you saw it buckle. You saw it go bad. It's not good. I feel bad for Christian McCaffrey, but it's like, yeah, Trent Williams is old. You're injury prone. You're injury riddled. It's over. Like, this window is done. Brock Purdy is fine, but he's not an elevator in the same way that these other quarterbacks in the NFL are. I don't think that they can just replace Christian McCaffrey with any other running back now. And what I thought was interesting and what I have found interesting about the Niners over the last couple of weeks is that they've looked soft. They've looked soft. They've looked defeated. And yes, maybe some of that is that, again, you're playing so many guys down the lineup. And part of it is that maybe they feel like this season is over. Maybe some of it is just like the amount of tread that's on the tires after all these playoff runs. But they just look completely cooked to me. Anyways, Brady joins us again. Yeah, we're talking about the Niners, and I don't know how much you heard of that. It's like, I'm with you, though. I feel like we learned more about them because I don't think that this is – I've had all this respect for them that's been built in. Like, oh, don't worry, they're going to bounce back. And if my life's on the line, how many teams in the NFC am I picking over the Niners? And I would have said, yeah, truthfully – up until a couple of weeks ago, it would have gone still Lions 1, but Niners 2. And now it's like, I don't think they're a playoff team. I think they've got real offseason questions about what the future is going to look like and how much they actually tear this down. But like, you go through their roster and you tell me how many of the guys that are identity players for them you're going to be counting on next season. And I think the list is going to be a lot shorter than most people would anticipate.
A ton shorter. By the way, the Christian McCaffrey injury was a PCL injury. Experienced that before, I'd have a hard time believing he's going to be able to come back this season with any effectiveness whatsoever. Mm-hmm. So he's one of those players that you might as well just say, like, let's hang it up for the season, move on. Because
yep.
I'm with you. I mean, it's hard to count them out because of the lack of parity in the NFC. But the truth of the matter is, I think what's shined the most light to me is the fact that it is one of the oldest rosters in the NFL. And you've got to make a decision on Brock Purdy.
Mm-hmm.
And Brock Purdy at times this year has been absolutely phenomenal. However, that being said, is like, they don't have the depth. They haven't, you know, had the ability to build up this roster to be able to pay Brock Purdy what it costs to pay some of these franchise quarterbacks now and then build out around him. And then for the point that you made, if he's not a guy that can elevate the level of play of everyone else around him, like a Josh Allen, like a Patrick Mahomes, Lamar Jackson, et cetera, then you're paying a guy that you still need to find cap space to be able to put players around him.
Mm-hmm.
Or you have to be able to hit on every single draft pick, which they've been good, but you know, clearly there's been some misses through the years, and there's also been some times where they've dealt with injury anyway. So they're in quite possibly one of the most precarious situations of any team heading into this offseason because of the decision on Purdy, because of this roster situation, this aging roster, and some of those superstars that, as granted, as good as they are when they're healthy, some of them just aren't healthy enough. So this is going to be a time for Jed York and the San Francisco 49ers organization and John Lynch to really kind of look in the mirror and see, like, you know, can we turn this thing around in 2 years? Because it's probably going to take that, and it's probably going to take ownership spending a lot more cash in how they go about structuring some things moving forward if indeed they do sign Brock Purdy to the extension that I think they're probably going to this offseason.
Yeah, I think that they're going to because most teams just do it. And yeah, I would say to them, like, what are they looking at alternative-wise unless there's somebody in the draft that they really feel that they can hit on? And I would imagine that they're sticking with Shanahan. I know that, like, a lot of Niners fans are down on him right now, and they're talking about how he's not clutch, and he's he's the coach who blew it to the Patriots, and then they gave him the run, and he's blown all these Super Bowls, and he hasn't done it. I was like, I just can't imagine them finding a better coach than him or being smart moving off of it. But, yeah, unless there's a quarterback that they feel they can hit on, in the draft, it's just, it's really, really tough for me to think that they're going to move off of Purdy, even though to me, it's like one of those situations where you go, maybe you should, because maybe this thing is actually going to turn into a rebuild a little bit more quickly. Not a lengthy rebuild because of the coach and the expectation there. But I really do think that this like CMC era, this Trent Williams era, this Deebo Samuel, like all these guys, like it's done, it's over with. And I take great pleasure in that because they should have won a Super Bowl and they didn't. They choked it. And it feels so good as a Seahawks fan to see this happen. Okay, so the Bills side of things. I have a couple of Bills thoughts. And one of them is you're right. The offense is far more balanced, and I do feel more positive about where they're at as a group this season. Like, I think that their defense is good. I think that their offense is reliable. I think that you can remove pieces from it and still feel confident about Josh Allen. I think that he has grown as a player to a certain degree, but it also made me realize I think this needs to be the Bills' year. Just looking at the AFC landscape, you've got a Pittsburgh Steelers team that's really good, but I don't think great, and still does have Russell Wilson as their quarterback, as good as he's playing. I can't just believe that he's going to make for a Super Bowl favorite. The Chiefs look vulnerable, more vulnerable than they ever have. The Ravens look like a roller coaster ride. It's always up and down. And now you throw the Justin Tucker thing into the mix. And I think that that's a real variable for them. The Texans are terrible. And that division has no representative that I think is going to be at all interesting. Like, the Bills suddenly feel to me like not necessarily the favorites, but all of a sudden there's like more pressure on them than any of the other groups, save for maybe the Ravens.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, although, there's always going to be pressure that comes along with it, the reality is they've already clinched the division, if I'm not mistaken, with that win last night.
Yeah, they do. They didn't even play the Patriots.
It goes to show you how bad the AFC East is.
Yeah.
That's one thing. And who knows? Maybe it's different if Tua's healthy and Miami's more of a contender in it, but I still think Buffalo would be the favorite. I think the Jets are a conversation in and of themselves. I mean, Aaron Rodgers, it seems like, is completely done. And I've got one specific reason why I think there's a big difference between his level of play, for example, at 41 years old almost here shortly, and Tom Brady at that time. But I digress. The thing that I think stands out to me about, again, the Bills is kind of, at least I've always felt like they've been a playoff team. Mm-hmm. The different version of this, because of the balance, lends me to think they're going to have a better shot because they don't have to rely on the passing attack and just Josh Allen. They have a more balanced approach to this. They're playing more physical on the offensive line. So that stands out to me. That and the fact that if they can continue to keep ripping off wins and get that number one overall seed, that's a tough place, tough environment to try to go through in order to get to a Super Bowl. So there's that element of the conversation. I think the one thing that I was watching last night in the game, and especially when you see kind of like the lateral to Josh Allen, he runs in for the touchdown, it's like, oh, there's the moment, right? Like, that's what's going to tip the scales. He's the favorite right now to win the MVP. And then I kind of got lost up in the fact of like, wait a second. Like, Lamar Jackson's putting together a season that's like incredibly better than last year where he won the MVP. He's leading the league in yards, over 3,000 yards. He's probably going to sniff or come close to about almost 1,000 yards rushing when it's all said and done, and throwing for over 4,000 yards. He's leading the league in touchdown passes. I believe like, what, 9 more than Josh Allen may have, or whatever the number is. It's like, have we just forgotten about it? And is this all going to be about team success at this point for Josh Allen and the Buffalo Bills to give him his first MVP? And then we just forget about Lamar Jackson? But I guess the counter to that is we gave Lamar Jackson the MVP last year and had a lot more to do with team success than stats. But that's, kind of one of the more interesting storylines, I think, as we head down the rest of the season, is the seeding for Buffalo and how important that is, but then the MVP race. And then could this be Josh Allen's first opportunity to win that MVP?
So I have the MVP race now. Allen 1, Lamar 2, Saquon 3. And I thought that it was just like this race is so close that a week like this did flip it for me a little bit. Like, I had Lamar all season long. I think that there's an extremely strong case for him. In fact, I've been saying that it's Lamar, it's Lamar, it's Lamar. But there were a couple things that stood out to me with Allen yesterday. One is just like, it's not like Lamar Jackson has the greatest set of wide receivers in the world. Like, he still throws to Aguilar a lot in the clutch. He's gotten a lot out of Bateman this year. But I do think Trey Flowers is very, very good and a big weapon for them. I also think that Andrews has found himself, wasn't healthy for the entirety of the season. And then there's been the thing with Derrick Henry, who came in and really helped shape some of that offense. I think this is the best version of Lamar Jackson that we've ever seen. If I was him, I'd be going, hey, man, don't even worry about the MVP. Like, you have one prize that really matters to you. With Allen, it's just been the amount of pieces that they removed to lose your number one wide receiver and then to be handed a rookie, to have Khalil Shakir out for weeks, you know, to lose. They also lost their number two in Gabe Davis. And I get that, you know, Gabe Davis wasn't exactly, you know, I think Mr. Clutcher, my favorite player, but he was still their number two wide receiver. They've brought in Cook and Davis, who give them a different look to their offense. But if you're telling me right now who I feel has meant the most to their team and who has been the guy who's got the better record, and all of a sudden it's just, it kind of gives me the slight lean towards Josh Allen. The thing is that this could flip for me week in, week out. I think that if the Bills did lock up the one seed, that it would kind of be Allen's award, because the team success would be that added variable. But yeah, it's, to me, it's between those two guys. And even though I actually feel like Saquon should be actually a little bit closer to them, but he just won't be. I know that's right. The reality of the situation.
Well, yeah, I mean, we haven't seen a running back since Adrian Peterson in 2012, was it?
So, no, but look what he did yesterday. He completely choked the life out of that Baltimore Ravens team. Like, once he got going, like, first quarter, they couldn't contain it, or they contained him. And then from that point forward, it was like the game shifted because Saquon just took over.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. I mean, I think, honestly, like, looking at it, if you're trying to make an argument, you know, and you look at the Eagles since the bye, why they've been so special, it's been Saquon.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he would be the singular reason. You'd say, like, well, what's the difference for their offensive success and all that stuff? Is that Kellen Moore? Is it this? I mean, no, it's been Saquon this year, the addition to him to the offense. But I also want to push back a little on the Lamar thing, because as far as the team record goes, and you mentioned it, I mean, if Justin Tucker can just make some kicks, probably a different team record too. You know, maybe we're looking at a Baltimore team that's not a wild card team right now, and maybe we're looking at them as more of an AFC North, you know, contender more for the division. I mean, I'm not saying they're still can't right now, but Justin Tucker, unfortunately, has played a really big role in where Baltimore is at this point in time.
Yeah, he missed more kicks yesterday than he's missed in almost all of his seasons as a pro, like over the course of each year individually. So yeah, it's bad. I just thought last night they didn't lose because of Justin Tucker. Did it? Is the game changed? Can you go through it and do the, like, space-time continuum of what happens if he makes the first ones? Yeah, maybe. I think there's a case for it. But, like, to me, it was like Lamar still only had 200 yards passing. He scored 10 points on the first two drives, and then the rest of the game they kind of disappeared. And so to me, it's just like it is. It's kind of a week-to-week thing where I go, as great as this guy's playing, when I'm watching those two quarterbacks, to me, it's just very clear that they're playing at the highest level right now. Both of them are doing so much for their teams. Both of them are playing, like, essentially flawlessly. I just don't have a wide discrepancy between the two. So I have to lean on the fact that, yeah, one team is 8-5 and the other one is vying for the best record in the NFL. And that Lions game that's coming up for the Bills is going to be massive, massive, massive. Because, if they win that one, and you look at the Chiefs' strengths of schedule, I think the Chiefs have four games left against playoff teams, and they've been scraping by, you know, the Panthers and the Raiders. They basically need help from the refs and screw-ups from Pierce to get that done. I think that the Bills have a pretty good shot at locking that thing up. Like, I do. I think that they're there.
No doubt about it. I mean, you're also mentioning, like, a matchup that I think we'd all probably love to see in the Super Bowl, too, if it was possible. I mean, can you imagine those two fan bases, Buffalo and Detroit, scoring off in New Orleans? Like, that'd be incredible.
Honestly, I don't even want that, because it's just too much for the loser, right? Like, it's too, the loser of that, like, for me to, I don't know how I would root there. I would root probably for the Bills. I'm going to make the case. I think they have the best fan base in all of professional sports right now. But God, just to see the losing side of that, I would be crushed. I would be genuinely so sad. Like, if you can't beat the other tortured franchise, right, in that Super Bowl, how do you move forward? That's a tough one. To kind of close the thoughts on, we kind of hit on the Eagles, but they're officially the number two team in the NFC now, right? Like, do you view this as a pretty wide gap? It's kind of like, hey, now we've got the Lions still top of the pile. Then it goes Eagles and then Packers in behind them.
Are we just not believing in the Vikings? Is that how it is?
I don't believe in the Vikings.
I mean, look, I know. No one believes in Sam Darnold, man. I kind of feel for him. I feel bad for a team that has the record they have at this point in time. He's playing the best football he has in his career, and you just kind of wonder, like, all right, you know, who knows how different we'd view Sam Darnold given where he was drafted and what he looked like coming into the league if he's linked up with Kevin O'Connell and Justin Jefferson as his wide receivers. So I'd like to think the Vikings, because of their defense, because some of the weapons and the way Darnold's played for the majority of this season.
Yeah.
But I'm with you. I think it's Detroit, it's Philly. I mean, those are by far and away the top two I was trying to kind of hold on hope to think San Francisco could turn things around, but that's just not going to happen. And then you've got this other tier in Minnesota, which, there's, again, I think they're probably closer to those top two than maybe one will give them the credit. But, I mean, I don't know. Maybe you could say Jared Goff and Jalen Hurts are a wide margin better than Sam Darnold. I think on their best day, I'm not sure there's that big of a difference. It's just more about the floor. And I think on their worst day, you know, Sam Darnold has showcased greater struggles than what we've seen from Jared Goff and Jalen Hurts.
I think Darnold is fine. I actually am. I would classify myself as more of a Darnold believer. To me, I watched a lot of that game. I also had bet on Minnesota, and the Cardinals gave that away. Like, they got into the red zone multiple times, and then they turned conservative, and they're doing all these, like, throws not to the sticks and bad-timed run plays. They finished the half where they could clearly go for the end zone, and they decide to throw this little short play and then get up to line all slow and settle for a field goal. Then Kyler throws two disastrous interceptions that kind of get them back into the football game. It just, that one was your classic, I don't really feel like you won this game. I feel like the other team lost it. And so I'm not coming away from it as impressed as I should be, despite the fact that, like, on paper, they just had this awesome comeback.
I'm okay with that, though, because you got to win sometimes that way in the NFL.
Yeah, I'm not saying you can't. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I'm just saying, like, New England Patriots, like, made that essentially, like, they're not their motto necessarily. It's always been do your job, but, you know, they've relied on teams losing games more so than they always won games. And there is something to say for that. So, it's really a credit to Kevin O'Connell and Kwesi Adofo-Mensah. I know we've talked about that before, but, you know, this was supposed to be a rebuilding year, and instead it's a year where, you know, Minnesota's abiding for a potential number one spot in the NFC. There's still some divisional games left to play. I think they finished with two divisional games. Who knows at that point in time if that isn't necessarily for the number one overall seed with the way things are going right now for Minnesota.
Okay, I'll rapid fire these next few ones. Where do the Bengals begin on defense? Because that's clearly got to be the change for them. I did a stat you should know earlier. Their teams are 79-7 when scoring 30 or more, and Cincinnati owns four of those losses this season. Like, obviously it's on the other side of the ball, but what do you try to fix first?
It's probably going to be Lou Anarumo who they move on from. You have to make a change at coordinator. And it's unfortunate because I do think he's a good defensive coordinator. But that being said, and it's crazy to think, too, a year ago, I think he was interviewing for head coaching jobs. So, I mean, just how different a year can make. Mm-hmm. But that's most likely the first change they're going to end up having to make. And I think Zach Taylor almost has to do it because otherwise the ownership might be looking at him and saying, hey, man, we feel like you're wasting time here with Joe Burrow. And, you know, you need to get on more on top of this. So I would imagine they make a change in defensive coordinator. And then from there, you know, have to look at the draft being heavily weighted towards defense. With the exception of saying, do we want to bring in, you know, someone else, as we probably allow T. Higgins to move on in free agency, do we want to bring someone else to help out with Ja'Marr Chase? And do we just kind of feel like with a change in coordinator, adding a few pieces through free agency, which usually Cincinnati's not a big spender, but also through the draft on defense, can we do enough there where, you know, some of these, you know, 30 plus point games that we're scoring or 300 yard passing games too that Burrow's had where they end up on the losing side of it, it can maybe change the tide for us, but it probably will be Lou Anarumo who's somewhere else next year.
I do want to say too that I give the Steelers a lot of credit for this win. I know that the Bengals defense is a disaster, but Bengals knew they needed to have that win. They've needed to have other ones, but for them to go up there and to put a 40 piece on them and to look the way that they did, and to just consistently deal with, hey, they got scored on, whatever, they get the pick six that goes against them, that's probably a penalty, and just keep battling back and keep just kind of kicking their teeth in. I that was a bit of an actual, that game changed more of my perception about the Steelers than truly any other one of these wins that they've been accumulating throughout the year.
Well, what I'm going to say next, you're not going to like that. I think Russell Wilson's played as well as any quarterback since he's taken over. And people can, you know, poke and prod at all of that, but he's been a perfect fit for what they're doing now.
I agree.
It's even impacted Najee Harris, and it's, you know, impacted their ability to stretch the field vertically. He's playing as good of a quarterback spot as you'd have to go back to the prime of Big Ben and what some of those offenses looked like. But Mike Tomlin, again, we've talked about this. He made a gutsy call in making the change, but he knew what he had in Russell Wilson. And so credit to him and the job they've done, because they're atop the AFC North. They look like one of the teams that I would not want to have to play when it comes to playoff time. A guy who's experienced, who's been there before, who's won a Super Bowl, been to a couple, like that, with that defense, with that offense, those weapons, like that feels like a recipe for disaster for the Buffalo Bills or the Kansas City Chiefs or the Baltimore Ravens have to face them in the playoffs.
No, I'm there. I saw this little video. I think it was Najee Harris who was filming Russell Wilson after the game where he's calling Mr. Unlimited and doing the thing. And he's like, Russell Wilson was dressed like all the all black. Like he was looking good. And I was like, oh man, Russ is back. Like Russ is back. He's there. He's got the swagger again. He's got that attitude. He's feeling himself. He's feeling his game. He's making plays down the field as good as any quarterback in the NFL right now. Like, tell me who you'd rather have throwing the deep ball right now in the NFL. Like, I'll wait. You can tell me, but I'm telling you, it's back to being him. He's back to having that special skill set. I just think the only thing that's going to derail the Steelers right now is George Pickens is going to do something dumb every single game, and it's just a matter of when it's going to happen. Because you know he's going to do it. If that was the quintessential game for it, because the Bengals went into it saying, we know we can get in his head, and literally, like, second drive of the game, he's dropping the football on somebody and pointing in their grill, and his teammates are grabbing. And I was like, dude, this guy is just... we haven't had a guy like him in a while who's just an automatic, every game, going to do something dumb guy.
Yeah, I think it'd be so appropriate for the Pittsburgh Steelers at some point, probably in the second round, third round, to go get, I believe his name, first name is Kyron Lacy. He's a wide receiver for LSU. It would just be a perfect fit for, one, the talent that, you know, Pittsburgh seems to always draft at the wide receiver position, but also, like, a player who's been reprimanded multiple times for doing the whole, like, machine gun shooting at the player across from him.
I love the machine gun shooting, though. Just let it be. Let them shoot their fake guns. There's nothing wrong with that. Like, that's the ultimate thing. Like,
I do appreciate the fact that they're like, oh, little kids are watching, then they're going to be doing this. Yeah. It's like, okay, I don't know if there's a translation to kids doing this on the football field, and then all of a sudden kids doing this on the street.
Those same little kids who are all playing video games that involve first-person shooters, like, this is the stupidest thing of all time. Like, it's really dumb.
Yeah, exactly. But let's go ahead and outlaw it with a fake one when in real life they're, like, preparing flying video games.
Yeah,
like that.
That's what I mean. Yeah, it's like, yeah, no, crackdown on real gun violence in the States? No. Crackdown on NFL fake guns? Sure, let's do that. Anyways, Aziz El Shaair, what do you do with that?
I think you have to suspend him.
Same.
I mean, the NFL is going to have to come down hard. He's made some, you know, plays in the past, too, that have been kind of dirty. So, I think you have to come down hard on an instance like this because it seemed pretty deliberate. I'm not sure how you defend it. I saw some videos on X that were basically comparing it to, like, the hit of the season back when Mike Singletary played, just how much the game's changed. So I was like, well, I mean, the reality is the game has changed, and, like, we've outlawed this for a while now. It's not like this is, like, some revelation that, oh, we've changed the way we're hitting quarterbacks when they're in the defensive position. So he's got to be suspended. I don't know if it's for two games or maybe even say four and let him appeal it if he wants to, and then maybe bring it down to two because it feels like he's been a repeat offender in some ways. But it's got to be a suspension at least for a couple of games.
Yeah, I think that there have been plays where quarterbacks have slid late, or there's the stuff we've talked about, right, with Mahomes on the sideline where I think he gets a little cheeky, and I wouldn't mind if a player blew him up once in a while. But that was just like the ultimate obvious sliding guy goes head first, cracks him. I would give him the four games. I would have zero issue with that. And you know me, like, you and I talk about this all the time, the fear of turning into flag football, league getting too soft. It takes quite a bit for me to go, yuck, suspend someone, rather than like, oh, it's fast game and how do you legislate it? That was too dirty. I'm sorry. You look at the track record, you look at where Trevor Lawrence was, how ugly and violent the play was, and how what the state that Lawrence seemed to be in right afterwards, where he was doing with the fencing motion. And I went, got to get this out of the game. Cannot have this one. Got to have, like, a very, very, very strong precedent that you don't hit the quarterback when they slide. Last one. Is it time for my guy Penix? Because Cousins has three straight losses with six interceptions and no touchdowns. And he was brutal in that game.
Yeah, that was one of the worst games he's played, I believe, dating back to 2022 as far as throwing three picks like that. And he just... he's been really inconsistent this year, even throughout games, but even at times he's looked like, okay, we're kind of coming back from the injury and we're starting to look better. And then at other times he just is kind of looking his age and looking like a guy coming off an injury on a new team and a new system, playing with new guys around him. So I'm not quite there yet because, I mean, really no one's out of it right now in the NFC South. And I do think, you know, if you look at the data and look at the numbers, it helps. You know, Michael Penix also, you know, obviously, you know, needs a little time, you know, and all that. But I just think, if you give him a year to learn, sit, and grow, and really become more settled in the system, it's going to be big from the following year. But I think more than anything else, this has probably shown us that this will most likely be the last year for Kirk Cousins. I mean, I'm not sure if they feel like they can deal him or what they want to do with the contract next season, because he's going to be a really, really high-paid backup, but that's where this is leading me more towards, like, looking at Kirk Cousins, looking at Aaron Rodgers, and just kind of getting back to that point where I wasn't really able to make it earlier. There's a reason why Tom Brady, at what, 44, 45 years old,
yeah,
was able to still play at such a high level for the Tampa Bay Bucks. And it's the fact that he was willing to make the sacrifice that no other quarterback has been willing to make for 365 days a year. Everyone does the same work during the season. Mm-hmm. It's the off season. The devotion to the diet, training, his preparation. He wasn't going to ayahuasca. He wasn't in Egypt. Like, he was preparing to try to go win a Super Bowl. And unfortunately for Aaron Rodgers, that hasn't been how he's handled his off seasons. And because of that, I think it's led to a player that's coming off an injury that just doesn't look anywhere near close to what his peak is. And he's a first ballot Hall of Famer, but the reality is, it's like, this thing is ending very poorly for Rodgers. It's probably going to end very poorly for Cousins as well.
There is literally only one place that makes sense for Cousins next year. One. And it's back with Kyle Shanahan. It's in San Francisco. It's if they walk off Purdy and then they bring him in. That's it. Go through it.
It'd be a bridge year, though.
Yeah, for sure.
Looking at,
but go through
like it. Like the 49ers hoping and praying that, like, Carson Beck falls the second round.
Yeah, that's what
you're doing. Or they find someone to develop for a year.
That's the only way that I actually think it would be smart. It's this outcome that I'm scared of as a Seahawks fan, that they go, we're not overpaying Purdy, who we figured out enough on, who is, hey, thanks for the run, thanks for the ride, but we're moving off of you. We're taking 1 year of Kirk Cousins, and I think that, you know, it'll be fine from a financial standpoint. You get 1 year, you draft somebody, and you let him, do the same thing as the Purdy model, where he learns the offense, he sits behind Kirk Cousins, they'll find ways to kind of win games, there's no real pressure on him, and then you move on. That's it. Like I said, again, if next week you could tell me, come on, go through the teams, look at it, and tell me which team would ever take on Kirk Cousins as anything other than a Joe Flacco role. I don't see it. I went through it yesterday, and I was like, nope, that's it. That's the only one, that's the only team where I think that he would start.
The easiest way, I was just going to say, the easiest way, we'll forget the Cousins side of this, but going back to Brock Purdy, the easiest way, I think, for the 49ers to justify or make any sort of decision with Purdy moving forward is, if we let him go to free agency, who would sign him and what would that contract look like?
Yeah. It's a good point.
I mean, in all seriousness, like, what team is looking at him saying, oh, we're going to give him a monster deal and bring him in and do that?
Yeah, the Jets doing that? I don't think so.
That's the hardest part for, I think, Brock Purdy and his representation. Is he's got all this equity built up. He's a winner. He's this. He's that. Well, it's all right. Well, let him go test the free agent waters. Mm-hmm. Let's eventually get to the point where if it gets to that, let's see what that looks like. And let's see what that contract looks like. So there's a part of me that feels like this thing's going to play itself out the long way, mm-hmm, with San Francisco and Brock Purdy, unless he just takes a much more economical deal to be the guy where they can basically get out from it within 2 years.
Yep. I think you're bang on with that one. Brady, thanks as always for the time, buddy. We'll talk to you next week.
Always a pleasure.
Cheers, pal. Brady Quinn, former NFL QB and analyst for Fox Sports. And, of course, the Monday Morning Insider of the show. Okay, I'm going to do this rant right now because I want to do it before the break. I was thinking a lot about the Bills yesterday. Naturally, they're playing in this beautiful snow game. And it felt like a real just celebration of them. Josh Allen has this incredible statistical game where, again, he does things that are unprecedented. They beat a Niners team that, yes, is completely obliterated by injuries, but they handed it to him. And what do we always say about really good teams? When they play a bad team, they beat the crap out of them. And that's what the Buffalo Bills did. And they did it in their house, and they did it with the snow. And you kind of felt that momentum of, like, holy crap, if the AFC does need to run through here and you got to show up in that snow and face Josh Allen and that running game, you are not going to be feeling good about it. You are just, there's no way. If I was a Chiefs fan and I cared about winning another Super Bowl, because maybe you're just there sitting on, resting on your laurels and you're happy with what you've accumulated and you go, yeah, you know what, that was fine. I wouldn't want to be going there for a playoff game this year. I'm sorry. I don't care if you're the Kansas City Chiefs. They're built different. They are built for that kind of weather. They are built for that climate. And all I came away from that game feeling was, this actually does. It doesn't have to be the Bills' year in the sense of, like, the window will close. I did this at the beginning of the season. Who is the person that bought into the Bills before anybody else? Me. I said it. Everybody in the media loves to rush out and close the window on the Bills. It's a yearly tradition that they lose one guy and everyone panics over it, and they never do it for anyone else. And granted, the Bills have lost and they've had heartbreaking moments and whatever. Patrick Mahomes exists, the Chiefs exist, that's a real thing. But every, seemingly so many, I won't say every because that's too hyperbolic, but it's so many football commentators have tried to write off the Bills. It's why the Bills put together that compilation that you saw on their social media yesterday of like, keep talking, we'll go out and keep winning, or whatever the quote was. Everyone loves to do with them like no other team in football to me right now. And all I said was, as long as they've got Josh Allen, they got a chance to win Super Bowls because he is that special. He is that guy. But there is more pressure this year, in my opinion. Because the Bills do have something going on right now. There is a chance for them to finish at the very top of the AFC. Like, it is within striking distance. If they win that game against the Detroit Lions, I don't think that the Chiefs are going to pull this out where they run the table and they don't miss any other games here. They're flawed. They're scraping by teams just to get some of these regular season wins. They've needed, think about what the Chiefs have needed in order to do this, right? Like that Antonio Pierce screw up, and whatever you want to say about the refs, fine. They had Isaiah Likely's toe that was a millimeter too big for them to end up getting a win against the Ravens. They have the blocked field goal against the Denver Broncos. Like, how many, they have the pass interference call against the Bengals. Go on down the list. The Chiefs have had break after break after break this year. This is going to start to swing the other way. It just is. And now they're playing four good teams down the stretch, four hungry teams down the stretch. And I think that they're going to drop maybe two of them, but certainly one. I don't think that they run the table. So the Bills have the opportunity where Josh Allen is in an MVP prime season, where they have a chance to host the entire AFC playoffs and be the only team that gets the bye, which, by the way, when you do that, it's like 80% of the teams that are represented in the Super Bowl are the teams that end up winning the bye. And you have the Chiefs at their lowest of lows. I don't care if you think that they can flip the switch. That's fine. I think that they'll flip a switch too. I would still be afraid of the Chiefs in a playoff game. I'm not saying you utterly disrespect them and that you say that they can't get it done. No, that's too far. But in terms of their level of vulnerability, this is clearly as vulnerable as they've ever been. We don't know if Travis Kelce is going to show up and be his old self come postseason time. We don't know if that defense is as special as it's been in years past. We don't know if some of those other weapons are going to be able to emerge around Patrick Mahomes, because we haven't seen a lot of it yet. And we don't know how much of a toll these last bunch of years have taken on that group in its entirety when it comes to, again, the tread that is on the tires of the Kansas City Chiefs. The second part is, the Baltimore Ravens are flawed, okay? They're a good football team, but they are not a great football team. Their defense looks like it's rounding the corner and looks a lot better, but they're also a team with their own demons. They're not just some insurmountable team that you absolutely cannot beat. The Bengals are out of it this year. You've got no Joe Burrow, a team that embarrassed you in the postseason in the past. They're not in it. The Houston Texans are, like, are we even sure they're going to be in the playoffs? Because they suck. They just flat out suck. Again, who warned you about this weeks ago? Who said it weeks ago? This guy right here, watching all the games every single weekend, clocking them, making sure, getting as much in as possible. Texans stink. They're not doing anything. And if the Colts get in, don't start with that, because like, come on. You think the Broncos are going to win Super Bowls here? Like, look how watered down the AFC field is in comparison to years prior. It ain't the same. And yes, I really believe in the Pittsburgh Steelers. I do. I think they're scary and a very, very tough out. But as good as Russell Wilson's playing, if Josh Allen can't beat, what, 34-year-old Russell Wilson in a playoff game when he's hosting it, then that's bad. That's not good. So those are your opponents. It's not as deep of a field. It's just not. You've got the things that are going well for you. Your defense looks good. This is this many years into the Sean McDermott thing. You have the chance to go at home. I've gone through the case. This kind of has to be the Bills' year. Now, last thing. I'll actually tease this and we'll do this in what we missed, because I'll give you guys a second to think about it. Is there any fan base that is better than the Buffalo Bills fan base? Because I would argue strongly that there is not. And that's next.
Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
All right, so I set it up. I think the Buffalo Bills have the best fan base in all of sports. And here's why, and why yesterday reminded me of it. One, they donate to charities en masse. Happens many times. where Bills fans and their online community, they rally around someone and they will donate. Started, I think, or the first memory or recollection I have of them doing it was with Andy Dalton when he helped get them into the postseason for the first time in God knows how many years. But they will give money. They do it. It's part of their identity is charity. Number two, they just have, I'm not actually going to do this as like a list. I'm just going to say this. They really do seem like they look out for another and have a real community. And the Bills Mafia is a cool handle, and the jumping through tables thing makes them feel wild. But you need to shovel that stadium out of the snow. They show up for $20 and a hot dog, and they're just doing it every single time. They have had some of the worst losses out of any team in all of professional sports, and they still show up to watch their team with joy. And maybe part of this is that they have Josh Allen now, and there is really hope for the franchise after so many years of just being in the wilderness. But there's an excitement that Bills fans seem to have about their team that is different. They also don't have a crybaby Twitter fan base that a lot of teams in small markets seem to have, right? Like, we would all agree that Twitter is not the most fun place for those fans. Oh, boo-hoo, everything's against us. Bills fans never really seem to be that way. They just seem to be getting bombed at the games, having fun. Yes, trash-talking fans that come in, but also, you know, not overly violent. Like, this isn't Raiders games. Everybody's getting in scraps all the time. They're jumping through tables, having some drinks. They're going to make fun of you if you're wearing a different uniform, but not an unsafe environment. And again, so it's like they put up with that climate happily. They embrace it with joy. Great online presence. Cool handle. History of losing, and yet still this overabundance of joy, real community feeling, right? Where it's like there's small town teams. Like, everyone talks about the Packers with that way, like Packers. Bills deserve credit for that too. And just, yeah, completely embracing the elements of their team. Buffalo Bills fans are the best. Like, I'm looking through my list here. That's it. Those are my main points. Tell me who is more likable and who is more enjoyable than Buffalo Bills fans. Like, tell me, give me anybody who's even close, because I think that they're just like far and away number one. And that if they won a Super Bowl, imagine bumping into someone who was like, I'm mad that the Bills won. Who would do that? That's crazy talk. You guys got anything?
So you're saying this as like the most likable across the league? Like, people
every
are
sport.
Okay with that? If it's every sport, then soccer, it's not even close. It's not even a debate. You can pick any European soccer team.
What?
You can pick any European soccer team and their fan base is better.
Okay, I'm already immediately discounting. You mean the guys that fight each other in parking lots and have to be separated from the other opposing fans?
And the guys who have songs for every player, the relationship.
Yo, the songs
between
are great.
I'm
for that. That's great. Like, I love the songs. I love that. But no, when their fans win or whenever their teams win, everyone is universally upset that this other group is... Like, who's the team that people have been happy for? Maybe Leicester?
Leicester, yeah.
Yeah, that was one, but they're gone. They're nobody. You think people are like, yes, man, you won. Good for them.
So are you saying this as, like, they're the most likable if they win?
Yes.
Nobody would care.
No, they are the best fans in terms of across the board, just seemingly like good people, fun to root for, endure the losing, have an awesome tradition, have an awesome community. Soccer is dead last. Like, what are you talking about? Like,
no, soccer, talking about best fans, and they have
soccer has the most diehard passionate fans. No question about it. Like, you're confusing this. You just listened to that whole thing that I just did, and you're bringing up soccer fans. You're bringing up hooligans. Turn your mic off. Oh my God, you're banned.
I think I have to go to a Bills game to like agree with you. You know what I mean? I have to see it up close with my own eyes.
But who would you even compare it to? Who? Like, that's what I'm asking you for. Like, give me a team.
Armin. Say soccer.
No, say a team.
No, I'm trying to think of, like, best in terms of, like, it's fun
That's
to
what you're
root
supposed
for
to do
like
during
you,
the break.
Like, you want to be their fan, too, just because of how they act and how they feel like a community. Yeah, that's...
Then soccer.
I'm going to just say Lakers fans travel pretty
no,
well.
Like, oh, my God, this is this worst. Honestly, I don't think I can ever have you guys back on the show. That was as a big of a disaster as it could have possibly been. This guy,
okay,
the Lakers fans, brings up
like
the Lakers fans. The Lakers fans, like, you know what, fam? I think it's the Lakers. Like, no, everybody hates Lakers fans. They're annoying. They're celebrity-obsessed losers. And soccer is literally, they have to be separated. They can't even hang out with each other because they tear each other's throats out and despise when the other ones lose. Anyways, please send me good submissions at JD Bunkus Twitter and Instagram, because my producers are just like, oh, my God, it's a disaster. Nightmare. See you tomorrow.